I'd like to begin by expressing my gladness to be here in Israel. This is my first visit to this country. I've been in Israel just about a week or so now, but it feels a lot longer. And some of you might know, but some of you might not, that Stephen first made this invitation for me to lead a retreat with a Tovana group about 16 or 17 years ago. So, like an olive tree, you know, it grows slow but steadily. Yeah. But it's taken a while for the seed to bear fruit, but here we are. So, also, during that time, I discovered I had family in the district, just over in Engev, kibbutz on the other side of Lake Galilee. So it's been a wonderful opportunity also for me to connect with members of my family that I never knew existed. So delighted to have my cousin Yoel joining us this evening, and as one of the early kibbutzim from Engev. So this is a bit of a different mode of retreat and teaching form than many of you who've practiced with Tovana have experienced before. So we have a shrine with a Buddha image and candles and flowers. And so this is part of our customary way in our monasteries and out of the tradition of the southern Buddhist world in Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma, and so forth. And so I thought if I'm being invited to teach and to bring the flavor of Dhamma from my own particular background, I thought that it would be appropriate to invite the whole package. And so at the very beginning of a retreat and any kind of teaching, I always like to emphasize that the teachings that are given, the forms that are used, these are here for reflection and consideration. And so even though we'll be having periods of chanting and devotional practices each day, I should emphasize that nobody is being expected or compelled to join in, and that I emphasize that devotion cannot be obligatory. You can't have a kind of devotion by diktat. But rather it's something that is an expression of the heart and an expression of one's own interest and enthusiasm. So when we do chanting or bowing and such like, you are absolutely free to join in and to take part, or to just listen and watch and look as you choose. So please understand there's no pressure, either spoken or unspoken. Your names are not being taken about those who don't join in. But I feel it's one of the great blessings of the Buddha's way is that it's an open system. We can all draw as close as we like, and to take what parts of it that appeal to us, that speak to us, and are of benefit to us, and the things that are not of benefit, that don't appeal to us, are not meaningful, then we are encouraged to leave those aside. And that very spirit was one of the things that drew me towards the Buddha's teaching and this way of life and spiritual practice in the first place. So having said that, I thought I'd like to begin with chanting a blessing for you all, for us all. And so the scriptural language of the southern Buddhist world is Pali, which is a close relative of Sanskrit. So some of you might understand the words, or a few of them, and probably most of you will not understand it all. But I thought to begin with just chanting a blessing based upon what are called the four sublime abidings, or four divine attitudes: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy at the good fortune of others, and equanimity. And so during this time, just to let yourself listen. It's just a brief chant, but it's a way of, recognizing a beginning point for this time together. We're all setting out on this little adventure for 5 or 6 days together, and a way of, unifying our attention and to, set in place the resolutions or the intentions to guide our hearts towards these fine qualities: loving kindness, metta, compassion, karuna, mudita, sympathetic joy, or joy, delight at the good fortune of others, and upekkha, or equanimity, or serenity. Metta sahangatena cetasa ekang disang barittava viharati tata dutiyang tata tatiyang tata jatutang itiyo dhammado tiriyang sabati sabha tataya sabhavantang lokang metta sahangatena cetasa vipullena mahagatena apama nena averena ambaya pajena parittava viharati karuna sahangatena cetasa ekang disang varittava viharati tata dutiyang tata tatiyang tata chatutang ittiyo dhammado tiriyang sabati sabha tataya sabhavantang lokang karuna sahangatena cetasa vipullena mahagatena appamma nena averena ambaya pajena parittava viharati mudita sahangatena cetasa hekang disang parittava viharati tata dutiyang tata tatiyang tata chatutang ittiyo dhammado tiriyang sabati sabha tataya sabhavantang lokang mudita sahangatena cetasa vipullena mahagatena appamanena averena ambayapa jena parittava viharati upeka sahangatena cetasa hekang disang parittava viharati tata dutiyang tata tatiyang tata chatutang ittiyo dhammado tiriyang sabati sabha tataya sabhavantang lokang upekkha sahangatena cetasa vipullena mahagatena appamanena ave rena ammaya pajena parittava viharati tehi. At the beginning of almost every retreat that I've taught over the last 20 or 30 years, I like to emphasize a couple of particular qualities. So this chant, the verses I was reciting began with speaking about metta, loving kindness, and the words translated into English mean, I will abide pervading one quarter of the world with loving kindness. Likewise, the second, the third, the fourth quarter So above and all around, everywhere, to generate loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, free from hostility and free from ill will. When we hear about loving kindness, metta, as a quality in Buddhist teachings, in Buddhist tradition, often it's spoken about as being generated with a particular practice. You use certain words to talk about it. Use certain visualizations to, as it's described in that verse, to be spreading loving kindness above, below, and all around throughout the world in all directions. But loving kindness is not just a sweet sentiment. It's not just trying to like everything in the world. As anyone who's watched their mind or looked at the world for more than a few moments will realize that not all the world is likable. I don't think anyone would argue with that. That there are things in life that are bitter, are difficult, are painful, are cruel, destructive. And so, whether internally, so some kind of physical illness, an experience of pain, if you've had a migraine for 3 days, this is not something that is likable. We are not going to say, oh great, 3 days of migraine, you know, searing headache, and it goes on and on. Oh, whoopee, maybe it'll still be here tomorrow. I hope so. Yeah. I don't think anybody thinks that way. Yeah. I won't ask for a show of hands. So a three-day headache is not likable. Or if we have some tragedy in our family, a close member of our family dies, we feel sad, we feel upset. So there are experiences in our life that are not likable, that but yet loving kindness is not inappropriate in the way that we can deal with those experiences. So rather than loving kindness being just a sentiment that we are trying to make ourselves like, things within us that are not likable, or things outside us in the world, in the people that we live with, we share our lives with, some people are not likable either. You know, their actions are worthy of criticism, and they behave in ways that are dishonest or harmful. So we can't pretend that we like that, but we can have loving kindness towards those people, or towards those experiences of our own, or to experience the states of mind that we have of fear or jealousy or anger or impatience. We can have loving kindness towards those states without any kind of hypocrisy, or without being trying to just be positive. Or as it's Ajahn Sumedho, my teacher, would often say, without trying to think pink. We're not just trying to put a veneer pink sparkle over everything, saying, oh, everything is nice, I'm really happy about this. And but rather, I like to encourage the understanding of loving-kindness not as a sweet sentiment that we're trying to spray over everything, but more it's the attitude of heart that accepts the way nature is in a radical and complete way. So I like to use the phrase radical acceptance as a translation, a way of rendering loving kindness. It's that openness of heart, the complete openness of heart to the way things are in this moment, the way nature is, whether we like it or we don't like it, whether it is sweet or bitter. We can still not hate. We can still say, accept that even if we've had a headache for 3 days, right now this is the way things are. And maybe it'll change in a few minutes and it might ease off, which will be pleasant. But right now, it's this way. Or if you lost a loved one, someone close to you has passed away, then that feeling of sadness, of grief, can be present, and we can accept that. We can not hate it, not wish it to go away. It's still painful, it's still bitter, but that openness of heart that says, well, yeah, like it or not, here it is. Life is this way. It feels like this. And that metta is a learning how not to dwell in aversion, not to to say feel that we have to reject or hate or push away things that are difficult, and also the things that are beautiful and noble, that we can abide with a heart that is open and receptive and accepting. So I always like to emphasize this quality of metta, not as a separate practice, but in a way more as an underpinning for all of our spiritual efforts, whether it's to trying to develop concentration and a focus of the mind in the present moment, or developing insight, what we call vipassana, or seeing clearly into the nature of experience. In that, the attitude of loving kindness, there is a receptivity, an openness, a readiness to attend to the way things are without bias, without preference. So the theme of this teaching is the non-dual teachings of the Buddha. I think that's what's on the label. So, I thought this was particularly relevant if we're interested in these teachings of non-duality, or these deep wisdom teachings of the Buddha, then that this basic attitude, the fundamental attitude of loving kindness, of openness of heart, this in a sense is the foundation of say developing the insight into the higher wisdom, the more complete and full wisdom teachings of the Buddha. So in this respect, when we talk about openness of heart or acceptance, it's important to then, the next paragraph is, acceptance doesn't mean approval. It doesn't mean that we're trying to be glad that someone close to us has just died, or that we have a headache or an incurable illness. We're not saying that we approve of that, or that someone close to us is acting abusively, or they are deceiving us, or being hurtful. So to accept does not mean to approve. So, and I understand that English is not the first language of most people here, but hopefully as I speak about this, you can get a bit of a sense of the difference between those two. So to approve means to say, I like this, I'm glad this is happening, I will go along with this. To accept just means to, in a sense, say, here it is. Like the weather, I'm discovering that Israel is a bit colder. It's a very cool country. Israel is a lot colder than I expected. Fortunately, my sister gave me some socks just before I came here. So, and I got some warm clothing with me, so that's I'm very glad about that. So the weather is cool. So whether we like it or not, that's what the weather's doing. We can prepare for it, we can adjust to it, but that's what the weather is like. So acceptance means being ready to say, okay, whether I like it or not, here it is. This is the weather. We're on this part of the planet, it's this season, it's like this. So as I give instruction today and over the coming days, I'd like to say encourage in particular this basis of loving kindness, of radical acceptance as an attitude, so that then as we do the period, as we engage in the periods of formal meditation, trying to use the practices of concentration on, say, the mindfulness of breathing, or using a practice of inner listening, that as we're trying to focus the mind, then you're recognizing the need to deal with distraction without that same attitude of radical acceptance, so that we have the intention to focus the mind on the present moment, to say, use the feeling of the breath as a reference point. But then, of course, we remember things, we think of things, our imagination gets going, we find ourselves planning or worrying, we find ourselves recollecting, regretting, fantasizing. This is what the mind does, it's its job. It's normal for the mind to create distraction. So if we have an attitude of loving kindness, then rather than thinking of our distracted thoughts as the enemy or some kind of brain disease that we are then fighting against, rather we're learning to work with the mind in a collaborative way. And so to enter into Buddhist practice or to use Buddhist practice, we understand that the means and the end are unified. So if you use a means that is aggressive, if you start a fight against your thoughts, you're trying to make your body sit still and force it into the lotus posture, and you're determined to not move at all costs, then it'll probably be the forerunner to a trip to the osteopath, or at least some serious knee ointment. And similarly, if we start a fight with our mind, our thoughts become the enemy, become something that we're struggling against, then if that stressful, aggressive, contentious attitude is what we're using as a means, then the result is going to be stressful and tense and conflicted and contentious as well. So if we use, if we use an attitude which is non-contentious, which is collaborative, then we're still working to help let go of distracted thoughts. We're working with the posture to sit in a peaceful and calm way, but we're working with the body and the mind rather than against it. So the example I always like to give is as if we're training a young child. I see, you know, Israel is a country with a large population of children. And so many of you, I'm sure, have had the direct experience of working with young kids. And so when you're teaching a child to learn their letters, their alphabet, you know, if a child is, you know, 3 or 4 years old, they don't usually like to sit still for very long. And so they want to learn their letters, or you're keen to help them to read and write. And so you carefully put the crayon or the pencil in the hand of the child, and then you help them, you take hold of their hand, say, okay, this is how you make an A, one stroke down here, or one leg there, and then a bar across the middle. You're teaching them Roman letters. I'm not sure what the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet is. I'm uninformed in these areas. But you work with the child, you kind of even if they say, okay, I've had enough, Dad, and they want to race off, then you say, come on, let's do the second one, and invite them back, sit them down, you carefully, you know, take hold of their hand, and you make a second letter. This is a B. It's like that. You know, one stroke down, and then two big lumps off the side. That's what a B is like. So that the child's nature is restless and agitated. They kind of want to, but they kind of don't want to. They've got other important games to play. Just like our mind. So, okay. One member of the inner committee says, this is the time to concentrate. Okay, now I want to be developing my meditation. Yeah, that's what one member of the committee says, let's meditate. And then five other members of the committee say, no, I need to plan my trip to India. Yeah. I've got to decide what I'm going to have for supper, you know, the first day, I get home. I need to recollect that argument I had with my brother last week. These other voices chime in. But just like with the child that wants to jump up and do other things, you see, you recognize that's just the natural restlessness of the mind. Okay, come back, let's try the second one. Okay. Coax the child back, you sit down, take hold. So you're working with the agitated, enthusiastic, restless energy. So if you are relating, any of you have had an experience of relating to a child, and you say, sit down, shut up, but, you know, do what I tell you. And we've probably been on the receiving end of that. And it has a very negative effect. You know, there's instantly tension and stress within us and between us. So I like to emphasize this means of collaborating, working with the mind, working with the body, and that as the mind has the habit of struggling or getting annoyed with our thoughts or getting annoyed with the sounds that we hear around us in the room, or you hear the sound of the call to prayer from the mosque, then the mind says, oh, I wish that wasn't there, that's ruining my meditation. Then to recognize at that moment, oh, I'm fighting against the sound. The sound isn't there to annoy me. The sound is just the sound. Whether it's somebody coughing, or the door opening and closing, or sounds from the world around us, to see that we don't have to make the sounds into an enemy. Or if you're just beginning the retreat and suddenly your nose starts running, oh no, I've been healthy for the last month, and now my nose starts running. It's just incredibly inconvenient. Not now, but your nose doesn't listen to you. It's working for a different company. So as another member of the committee, you know, it's got its own agenda. So this has happened to me before. When you come to a new country, brand new group of people, and then you get this cold, that your nose is running like a waterfall, eyes streaming, sneezing into the microphone. This is extremely inconvenient. But then, here it is. So, the spirit of engaging in the practice of Buddhist meditation, I always like to emphasize that this quality of loving kindness or radical acceptance is important to establish as an ongoing presence, not just as a little extra practice we do at the edges, but it becomes the very attitude and the means that we use in developing concentration, developing insight, and the development of profound wisdom, wisdom into the non-dual liberating teachings of the Buddha. So then, as a follow-on from that, or a natural result of that, is an aspect of spiritual training that my teacher Ajahn Chah used to emphasize a lot. You know, he would say, "You know, you think that I'm the teacher. I've got Ajahn in front of my name. Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Amaro means a teacher, Amaro. But he said, actually, you are the teacher." I can sit up here and I can just spout all kinds of profound things day and night. But if you're not listening, or if you're full of your own opinions, and you're not really taking it in, then you're not learning. And he said, also, it's not just the person with the shaved head and the robe sitting up in the middle that's imparting the teachings. And it's not just in the shrine room that we learn, but rather every aspect of our life will teach us. So as we walk out of the hall, we go and have our breakfast in the morning, or that we can go to our sleeping place, that the way that we, say, interact with the other people that we're sharing a dormitory with, or the way we clean our teeth, or the changing of night into day. Every aspect of the world around us and within us will teach us if we let it. Having a streaming cold at the most inconvenient time, that becomes your teacher. That becomes your achan, your acharya. You're learning the lesson from the nature of sickness, the nature of the body. And so this is another attitude, another aspect of this retreat time that we have together, is to set that intention of letting everything be your teacher. The things that you are sort of formally being your teacher, like me as the voice up front, but also let the ache in your knee be your teacher. You know, let the difficult person that you're sharing a dormitory with be your teacher. Let the food that you're eating, the feelings that arise of tiredness or of agitation, as I said, the changing of day into night, night into day, to let those simple qualities of experience be your teacher. And that when we're wise, then everything will teach us. The ground under our feet, the air that we breathe, you know, the leaves on the trees, the feeling of of wind on our skin, everything will teach us if we let it. If we're unwise, then As Ajahn Chah would often say, you could have the Buddha sitting in front of you, giving you a one-to-one discourse, and you still wouldn't learn a thing if you're already filled with your own opinions and preoccupations. And that then even the greatest teacher in the world cannot teach you, because your box is already full. There's no room for anything in there. So again, another of the attitudes I like to encourage at the beginning of a retreat time, to set that as a clear intention to learn from whatever comes up, and then this is in a way it helps us to guarantee that nothing can go wrong with this retreat. Right? I was teaching a retreat one time, and a guy had a serious attack of angina, a kind of heart disease. He had to go off to the hospital, have a stent put into one of his, had a major surgery. Three of the other people from his local Buddhist group went and kind of helped look after him in the hospital. 3 days later, he came back and finished the retreat with us. So his 4 days in the middle of the retreat were in hospital. But he said, yeah, well, I kind of lost it a few times, Ajahn, but mostly I just kept the retreat going, but I was in the hospital bed. So I felt that was a really good example. I'm not suggesting it, you know. Anybody do anything to make a kind of a little holiday in the hospital, you know, during this week, but I was very impressed that he didn't think, oh, damn, my retreat's ruined. Yeah, I had to miss 3 days, because he wasn't saying, I missed 3 days of the retreat. He just said, I just kind of expanded the shrine room. Okay. Yeah, my meditation hall became the Santa Rosa General Hospital. I thought, well done you. Yeah. Many of you I've never met before. A few of you, we were having a city retreat in Tel Aviv last week, so there's a few familiar faces here, but many of you I've not met before, and I'm not really sure the extent of experience that many of you have in terms of meditation, and I'm sure there's a few old warriors out there that have been wearing out cushions for the last 20, 30, 40 years. And some of you, this maybe is just the first, amongst the first retreats that you've done, and the Buddhist teachings and the kind of language of sort of traditional Buddhist teachings is not familiar to you. So I'll try to speak in ways that address all the areas of the population, from those who are very new to those very experienced. The theme of the retreat is the non-dual teachings of the Buddha, and in some respects this is talking about the development of wisdom. And the main method or methodology, the ways of developing wisdom, as we understand it in the Buddhist terminology, wisdom is not knowing about things, it's not a lot of information about the mind or the world or the body. It's not information. It's not even a conceptual understanding. But when we use the word wisdom, it's referring to, in the Buddhist sense, it's referring to a way of seeing. So in essence, it's an attitude or a way of seeing the world, the mind, our life, and all things. A way of regarding and holding and relating to all experience. So I'm not sure what the words in Hebrew would be best to use to refer to wisdom. I know it's a word that's got all kinds of connotations. So we might say, you know, the wisdom of the scriptures, or the ancient wisdom, and it might mean particular scriptures or particular words or ideas. So to just underline that what I'm talking about here is the goal as a way of seeing rather than a particular set of ideas. and that the practices of concentration or samatha, helping the mind to focus in a clear and steady way on the present moment, that's in a way the first element of how such wisdom is developed. And the second stage, or the second key part of the practice or this process, is what we call vipassana, or learning to look into the nature of experience itself. So of a concentration, as I said, we'll, over these coming days, we'll use different exercises, both using mindfulness of breathing, mindful walking, and also a practice that is called inner listening, or to the Sanskrit term for it is nada yoga, where it's a kind of inner focusing upon the inner experience of hearing. I'll explain that more in days to come. But the practices of concentration, whether it's focusing on your footsteps as you walk, or whether it's on the feeling of the breath or whatever, the main purpose of samatha or concentration is to develop a collectedness of mind, so that we're training the mind, the attention, to rest easily in the present moment. So regardless of the particular object, at least from my point of view, my own training, it doesn't really matter what object or methodology that we use. The point of the practices that are, say, geared around concentration, it's really just helping us to develop the skill of attending to the present and not allowing the attention to be caught up in distractions. So this is the purpose of the first part of the practice, to bring the attention to the present moment. Then the element or the aspect of vipassana, or insight, it shouldn't be seen as something that's kind of separate or different. In some meditation schools you get, we just do samatha, we're just a concentration, you know, this is really important, developing deep states of absorption, jhana, that's really what it's all about. That's what real meditation training is. It's developing jhana, or the states of the mind's absorption into the meditation object. And then on the other side you have, no, concentration, that's just a kind of meditational day at the beach. It doesn't really have any value. Just having a focused mind doesn't really liberate you. Vipassana, vipassana, vipassana. Insight. This is really where this is what matters. So we're an insight school. We don't bother with samatha. So I don't know how many of you have had that kind of a conditioning or background. Maybe none at all. If you've been around the Buddhist meditation world for some years, then you can easily come across this, a kind of digression, or say a differences of opinion about those qualities, also seeing them as distinct and separate from each other. But if we look at the Buddha's teachings, more often than not, they're spoken of as a being in a natural relationship to each other, so that when the mind is concentrated on the present moment, when there is that quality of focus or samadhi, collectedness, then, as the Buddha says in one particular teaching, you know, there's no need for someone, when the mind is collected and focused, there's no need for them to think, may knowledge and vision of the way things are arise, because it's completely natural. If the mind is collected and focused, then that kind of insight will arise on its own. So that that natural relationship between the two, between the insight, like looking into the nature of experience, and the quality of concentration, they're in a natural relationship with each other. And an image that Ajahn Chah used to use, he said it's like a candle and a match. So concentration is like a candle. There's a lot of potential there. You've got a wick and wax. But if you go into a dark room and you've got a candle, but you've got no match, you can't see very much. There's a lot of potential there. You know, so he's saying, you know, if the mind is steady and focused, yeah, there's a lot of potential to find real freedom, real clarity and liberation, but the potential is not being fulfilled. So Vipassana on its own is like a match. You know, you strike a match in a dark room and you can see, but you can't see for very long because you don't have much fuel. You just got a little bit of wood that's the match stick, and then pretty soon it's gone. But if you put the match to the candle, then you can see for a long time. So it's a pretty simple and direct analogy. So Vipassana then is often when we, and I'm sure many of you have done, which Stephen's probably been explaining all this for many years, and I know many others of you have also been teaching through Tovana and well experienced in this field. Often when we talk about the development of Vipassana meditation, we say, well, when the mind is sufficiently concentrated and focused, then you let go of the feeling of the breath or the focusing upon the concentration object like your footsteps or whatever it might be. And then you, rather than focusing on a single object, you open the mind to experience the flow of perceptions, you know, the things that you see or hear, or smell, taste, touch, and allow the mind to, instead of looking at the content of the experience, you allow it to simply be aware of the process of experience, so that you, and then in that we use the reflections on change. So rather than I'm hearing this particular sound and it's Ajahn Amaro speaking, instead of paying attention to the content, you say, oh, this is, the sound is changing. There's the experience of change. It's anicca. It's changing. It's coming and going. Then also the quality of dukkha or unsatisfaction. It's this particular sound or this particular mind state or this particular feeling. It might be pleasant and delightful, but it can't stay forever. I can't keep it. It can't be owned. It can't be kept. It can't be permanently pleasing. Or something that's you know, already painful or unwanted. So that that the recollection on change, on unsatisfactoriness, and then on selflessness, on anatta, that there is no we might hear a sound and we don't think of there being an owner or saying that's my that's the sound that sound of a passing car or the sound of a door opening, that's, we don't think of that as my sound, but we experience a thought or an idea and we might recognize, we might think, well, that's me remembering, or that's my emotion, yeah, I'm happy or I'm feeling. But with it, when we are developing Vipassana meditation, developing this insight, then there's a shift of view. So rather than seeing things in terms of me hearing or me feeling or my mind or my thoughts, my memories, my ideas, there's a seeing that these are all simply patterns of nature. There is hearing, the hearing of a sound. There's the knowing of a thought, and that it's exploring that feeling of I and me and mine, and learning to see through that, learning to see that those perceptions of self-centered thinking, that this is, you know, my thought, my mind, my memory, my ideas, my body, you know, I'm hearing, I'm thinking, I'm seeing, that those self-centered ways of expressing things and holding things are insubstantial, that they are they're what we would, you can call a convenient fiction. And so that by shifting the view of how we relate to experience, then you can see what's more accurate to say: there is hearing, there's feeling, there's remembering, there's thinking, and that you can't fix or pin down, you know, what it is that is the one who's knowing that what is the owner of this thought or the owner of this experience or this feeling. So this is a sort of Vipassana in a nutshell. So this is hopefully this is a kind of known or familiar territory to most people here, I'm guessing. So I see a few people nodding. Yeah, good. So we often think of Vipassana as that kind of recollection, just telling ourselves, it's anicca, it's changing, or this is unsatisfactory, this is not self. And in that effort to apply that method, that we are in a sense making vipassana into the application of the method. So we say, as long as we're thinking, oh, it's changing, or oh, it's not self, or this is unsatisfactory, that this is indeed, it's the applying the method of vipassana. But the most important element of vipassana, or the insight meditation, is the actual change of heart that that reflection brings. So that when we remember an image, like being with my family in Engev over the last day and getting to meet many new people that I've been related to, then that feels like it's my memory. I'm remembering, I'm thinking. And then to reflect, well, actually, that's a memory that arises and passes away. What is it that owns that? What is it that knows that memory? Is there really a solid separate me that is the owner of that? Or is it a memory arising and passing away? Ah. And in that moment of, seeing that there's no findable I or me or mine there, to see, well, that's a sound that I hear. Yeah, these words might be interesting, they might be confusing, they might be illuminating, they might be irritating, but they are definitely changing. They're arising, they're passing away. It's anicca, it's changing. So, applying the method of vipassana, like bringing those recollections to mind, is one thing, but then what the important part is the change of heart. So it's like a key. Like, you put the key in the door, not because you want to put the key in the door, it's because you want to get to the other side of the door. So it's important to apply the method to get the key in the door, otherwise you don't get through the door. But the reason you're doing it is to get through the door. And that, so that then having opened the door and getting through to the other side, then there's the, that's the change that is the important thing. That's the purpose of putting the key in the door and turning it, is so that there's a radical change, a shift in the way that we see things. So that, I feel, is also important in terms of applying these kind of reflections or developing insight meditation. If we are really interested in trying to explore these non-dual transcendent teachings of the Buddha, then that's a very important element to bear in mind, that it's not just applying the method, but more noticing that change when there is that letting go, and that the heart opens to the way things are, when those self-centered habits of thinking are dropped, then what is experienced? What is the texture, the flavor of life, of our experience, our world, when those habits are dropped, when those the usual ways of thinking, the attachment to self-centered thoughts and self-view, are let go of? And how is life? How is this moment when those are carried out? Because and the reason why I emphasize this is that one of the difficulties of meditation is we can get so busy with the doingness, doing my practice, doing my meditation, being a good meditator. You know, not to make fun of that. Well, I am making fun of it. But because I've done it so much myself, you're being the keen meditator. You're doing the practice, and you can be doing it so sincerely, you forget there's me who's meditating, me the spiritual one, me the sitter. And all of that meanness and doingness, we don't notice that that's cluttering up the whole show. And that one of the beautiful aspects of the Buddha's teaching is that it's, as he described it, it's a raft to get you across to the other shore. We're conveniently close to the Sea of Galilee, and it's appeared in many religious teachings, as we know. But the Buddha described his teaching as a raft to get from one side to the other side. It's a means of getting across. So in that teaching, he said, if you are living on the side of a lake or a river that's sort of dangerous and difficult, and you know that there's safety and security and happiness on the other side, then you gather together sticks and wood and vines, and you bind them together, and you make yourself a raft, and then through your effort, you climb on the raft, and then you paddle away with your hands and your feet, and you can then make your way across the water to get to the safety of the other shore. So, but then when you've got to the other shore, what's the right thing to do with the raft? So, should you then pick up the raft and say, this raft has helped me so much, I'm going to carry it with me wherever I go. It's been so helpful, so good, I couldn't have got to this beautiful, safe place without my precious raft, so now I'm going to hoik it up onto my shoulder and carry it around wherever I go. Is that the right thing to do? You know, the Buddha would often ask, he would often ask these very loaded questions. You know, no. It's obviously not the wise thing to do, but rather you are grateful that the raft was able to be used to get you across to the other side, but then you leave it on the bank and you go on your way and you enjoy your life in the safety of the other shore. So this is a very simple and direct teaching, but it's also pointing to the use of methodologies, the use of meditation techniques, the use of shrines and the monastic form and the rules that we all live by in our families, in society, in the world. So it's a simple and direct teaching, but it's also a very profound and inclusive teaching, because it's pointing to how we use conventions and structures. So the one of the things to say that came to mind in terms of talking about the Buddha's most profound and liberating teachings, non-dual teachings, is that if we really want to understand non-duality and complete liberation, if we really want to understand ultimate reality, then we also need to fully understand and respect conventional reality. You don't really get the one without the other. If you're trying to just live in a completely sort of unbiased and sort of non-dual way, then this is going to be very difficult for you. If you want to make no distinction between left or right, your shoes are going to get very uncomfortable from time to time. You know, if you take non-duality in the wrong way, why do you put your right foot in the right shoe? If you take non-duality in a mistaken way, then you put your left shoe on your right foot just because you don't want to be biased. It's stupid, isn't it? No, we put the right shoe on the right foot. You know, we're women and we're men. And so if we grasp non-duality in the wrong way, you might say, well, there should be no distinction. I'll just go into the women's showers. Yeah. They shouldn't object. We're into non-duality here, right? Get out. What are you doing in here? This is the men's showers. You know, you're a woman. Get out. Wrong place. So when we kind of take hold of a principle like non-duality, or the mind free from biases, it's not a matter of doing away with conventions or saying, well, let's just pretend that we're not women and men. Let's pretend that right foot and left foot is just the same. Or we can maybe make shoes that work on both feet. I would suggest, and I'm offering this for consideration, I hope that I'm coming across in a way that's understandable, that I would suggest that it's not a matter of trying to ignore the conventions and forms that we live with. That my left foot and my right foot are not the same. They're different. Our conditioning and the laws of the country that we live in, the conventions of our families, our particular religious background, they are different. They vary. And so that it's not a matter of freedom from dualism is not a matter of defying conventions, pretending that they don't exist or wishing them away, but more learning to understand them and how to use them, but without attachment. And again, not to sort of exalt Ajahn Chah too much, but he was amazing. One of the reasons why I'm a monk, I've been a monk since I was 21, and you can tell I'm not 22. I've been doing this a long time. But one of the reasons I've been doing this a long time was the effect that meeting Ajahn Chah was, because he was well known to be an extremely strict monk, and a local saying in northeast Thailand around his monastery was 3 months at Ajahn Chah's monastery was like 10 years in any other monastery. It's like the sort of crack outfit, you know, the commando troops. So he was notably tough and demanding as a teacher, and very, very strict in terms of discipline about the way you sew your robes, the way you look after your robes, the way you look after your possessions. We have literally 10,000 rules. You know, 227 main ones, but if you count up all the little ones, it's something over 10,000. So, and he was very exacting, very demanding in the way that you conducted yourself. Like, there's a way that you put down your sitting cloth, and there's a way that you don't, well, many ways that you don't put down your sitting cloth. There's the ways that you put on your robes, and many, many ways that you don't put on your robes. And I'm sure within the Jewish tradition, you got 600 and something standard rules that I understand that I lived by. So not sort of comparing who's got more rules, but we all have our, well, it's called Vinaya in our monastic tradition. That's our discipline is referred to as the Vinaya. But yet, even though he kept all these rules and he was very strict, and, you know, and also personally, he was available to people 15, 18 hours a day. He would receive guests, people visiting the monastery, coming to ask questions, you know, solving people's meditation issues or marriage counseling or giving blessings or, you know, 1,000 different kinds of advice from about 9:30 in the morning till 10:30 at night, midnight, 1 in the morning, every day. He was completely available, and he lived a very, very austere life. But yeah, when I met him, and even though I couldn't understand the Thai language, I could see, here's the happiest man in the world. I thought, what? he's just, he doesn't even sit on a cushion. I mean, this is very luxurious here. What we've got, he just sits on a thin mat. He receives people 10, 15, 20 hours a day. He's never had sex in his life. Eats one meal a day. When the food would get particularly delicious, or things were getting very exotic in the monastery kitchen, he'd go in and scold the cooks and say, no, if the food's getting too delicious, you need to take it down a few notches. And he was proud of the bad reputation that the food had. Don't go to Wat Bopong, the food's really awful. And he's always good. So, here's this guy, no sex, no drugs, no rock and roll, definitely. And yet, why is he so happy? And you could see that, at least for myself in meeting him, you could see that he was someone who was completely, completely free and unburdened. But yet he still kept all these rules. And one of the things that really caught my attention was exactly that, was like, how does he do that? And why does he do that? You know, why does he keep all those rules or those forms and structures? And what became apparent over time was that exactly that, because I was coming here and staying at the kibbutz of Engev yesterday, it brought back to my mind a lot of the ideals I had as a young person, a teenager. I was very fond of this kind of idea of communal living and harmlessness and, you know, the sharing everything and having no money. And so the kind of kibbutz life and how it started out seemed to resonate that a lot. But I was more at the kind of formless hippie anarchist end of the spectrum when I was a teenager. But yet my efforts to be totally free and unlimited by rules ended up making me more and more neurotic and insecure and lonely. And so trying to have no limits, no rules, and to be free didn't seem to be working. And what I came across, or what was apparent in meeting Ajahn Chah and the way that embodied the Buddha's teaching, was that freedom isn't a matter of defying conventions and rules and forms, but learning how to be free within them. So we're defined by the body, its limits. You know, the force of gravity. You know, we feel that the need to breathe, the need to eat, the fact that we belong to a family, we live in a country countries that have rules, and so this was a very important and a helpful teaching, because it pointed to the conventions, the structures, the forms are there to help us to live in a simple way or a harmless way, to live in relationship with each other, but they're not things to cling on to or to identify with or to judge others with. Just like the Buddha saying, when you get to the other shore, you put the raft down. It doesn't mean you break up the raft and destroy it. You know, you're grateful for what it provided you with, but you can let it go and walk away. And so this is about learning how to use conventions and structures like mindfulness of breathing or vipassana meditation, following the rules of the retreat, no speaking, or, aggressive conduct towards each other, and so on. But the forms and structures, if we understand them wisely, then we are able to use the forms, but not be limited by the forms. And so, just like getting into a car is another example I like to give. You know, I don't regret the fact that I had to be sitting in a tiny little metal box, strapped in. Yeah. Can't move. Because doing that enabled me to get all the way across from the other side of Kennerit to here to Endor. You know, I was confined in a little box of a car, but then that enabled me to travel all the way over here because of my cousin Yol, you know, being kind enough to drive me over. So we use the limitation of being in a car. We don't mind that, because it provides us a greater freedom to get to distant places. So in exactly this way, we can relate to the limitations that we enjoy or we are using, and that we can find a freedom within them. And so that rather than, say, trying to find non-duality by defying duality, it's more like by understanding the dualistic world of this and that, here and there. Old and young, you know, good and bad, painful and pleasant. But it's by understanding the sense world, the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, by understanding it and say learning to work with it, then we find that unborn, unoriginated, timeless freedom that is within us, that is the fundamental nature of reality, the Satcha Dhamma, or the ultimate reality, that is able to be realized within the forms and structures, rather than as a something that is defying them. Or what, maybe the last thing to say on this is the word that the Buddha used. He created the word Tathagata to refer to himself. It doesn't seem to have appeared in any kind of Vedic scripture or any earlier time. It seems that the Buddha invented that word. And it comes from two parts. So a little etymological. I know it seems to be we have a lot of scholarly people here in this country that I've run into so far. So a little etymology, a little kind of word construction here. So Tathagata is made of two parts. So tat means thus or such. Tat or tata. And the word, the second part is either gata, so it'll be tata, tata, gata, which means thus, and gata is to go, from the Pali verb gachami, or gachati, to go. So it either means thus gone, or it could be tata, gata. Tat agata. So the A at the beginning of the second word is a negative. So it could mean thus gone or thus come. So, do you follow that? I'll say it again. So gata means gone, agata means come. So scholars have been debating for the last 2,500 years, does Tathagata mean thus gone or thus come? Gone to suchness or come to suchness? Or using biblical theological language, is the ultimate reality immanent or transcendent? Is it totally here or totally gone? And my pet theory is that the Buddha created that word precisely because it has both meanings. And that it is actually saying both, that the Buddha principle, the awakened principle is both totally here and totally gone. Fully transcendent, and fully present. Completely immanent and completely transcendent. And that the two need to be seen to be working together. So this is also reflected in one of the qualities of the Buddha, that when we do the chanting, it's recited as part of that. So the term is vijja charana sampanno. So sampanno means impeccable or consummate, or something that's fulfilled. Vijja is knowledge or awareness. Charana means conduct. So it means perfect in knowledge and conduct, or perfect in the quality of wisdom or awareness, and also perfect in activity. So that those two are a single quality. Vijja charana, like the conduct and knowledge, so that it's the vijja, or the awareness side of it, would be the transcendent, that transcendent awareness that's let go of everything. And then the charana is that which is totally attuned to the time, the place, the situation, the conduct that respects and is in tune perfectly with the here and now, with the sense world. So that during this week together that we have in prospect, this is a theme that I'd like to be emphasizing, is that the non-dual aspect, or the transcendent aspect of the teachings, it can only really be understood and realized and developed with its partner, which is the element of conduct. But by understanding conventions, then we can realize liberation. By realizing liberation, by realizing the transcendent, that in turn helps us to work with conventions, understanding the limits and forms of our body, our minds, and the world around us in a much more complete and realistic and comfortable way. So this is my opening reflections for us all. I've gone on a little bit longer than planned, but yeah, that's normal.